men alive when the earth stood still. That said war crimes on that freeway for a year, a scar that's hard to get to.
It's spring, and spring means Record Store Day.
Yay!
The holiday when we remember the ancient tradition of walking into a real live brick-and-mortar store and buying something, a custom rarely practiced after the advent of Amazon.com.
Did you know that this episode is the 9th episode of the Light in the Attic podcast?
I can't believe it.
I didn't think we'd make it this far.
I know, there was that. Remember when we were at episode 4 and we just stopped for a little while?
Yeah, I remember that. It was cool.
That was my bad.
It happens.
I was busy.
We got stuff to do. Like making these releases for Record Store Day.
Yes. On this 9th episode of the Light in the Attic podcast, we are going to talk about our 3 Record Store Day offerings.
I know some people are anti-Record Store Day.
We get it.
Scalpers suck, and it's not cool when people who don't care about the records buy a million of them and then flip them on eBay. We wish that we could do something about that, and we hope that record stores are making an effort to do that. Yeah, so scalpers gonna scalp, but long live Record Store Day. People gotta remember that they exist, and that's part of our livelihood as well.
I just think we always put out weird, cool stuff on Record Store Day.
Also, our record shop in the KXP building in Seattle is allegedly going to be carrying over 150 official Record Store Day titles.
Yeah. In addition to our own titles, we're carrying all of the Record Store Day titles.
That's a lot for a little space, but yeah. I think Brad can handle it.
Brad's our man on the ground. So today we're going to tell you about our 3 Record Store Day titles, play you some snippets of the music, and some interviews that we were lucky enough to conduct with some interesting characters who worked on the projects. We've got a director who was hanging out in Warhol's factory in the 60s, and we've got some surfer dudes. And we've got a classical pianist.
All sorts of stuff. Something for everybody.
And our 4th Record Store Day release, which is actually not a record, is the Light in the Attic zine, which we put out every year on Record Store Day. And it has little features on various releases from the past year. So there's features on Johnny Frierson, that lo-fi gospel soul album that we all loved, and Camberwell Now, British avant-garde noise project. Our coworker Yosuke wrote a piece about new Japanese music. What else? There's an interview with Betty Davis, original Nasty Gal. There's a crossword puzzle and an original chicken recipe from Ish Butler of Diggable Planets that our very own Hillary cooked and brought to a Diggable Planets show for Ish, and Ish ate backstage.
Yep. We were hanging out during sound check because I wanted to bring him some chicken.
I can't believe I didn't go.
You should have gone.
I had a date.
It might have been better than your date. Not going to lie.
The Light in the Attic zine is available at any record shop near you for free on Record Store Day, which is Saturday, April 22nd.
Record Store Day. Let's talk about the releases that we have coming out, because that's why people are listening, right?
Yes.
So the first one we have is probably one of the most interesting releases we've ever put out. It's called The Music of Gurdjieff de Hartman, a 5 LP box set. This set is by a Greek-Armenian spiritual leader named George Gurdjieff and a classical Russian pianist named Thomas de Hartman. I feel like describing it doesn't give it enough credit, but it is sort of a minimalist piano music box set.
Yeah.
But with the ultimate goal of achieving a transcendental state.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
It's like a
Which
little...
is why it is referred to as proto-New Age music, because it could be considered as the like body of work that laid the seed that would one day grow into what we consider contemporary New Age music. It was composed in 1923 to 1929.
But was recorded in the 50s. But it wasn't released on vinyl until 1985. And now in 2017, we are reissuing it for the first time.
After it was out of print for 30 years.
Yes. Is the music of Gurdjieff de Hartmann.
George Gurdjieff was a Greek Armenian spiritual teacher, and de Hartmann, Thomas de Hartmann, was a Russian classical pianist.
And their powers combined
equal this box set.
Yeah, allowed them to make some really amazing music. One thing we learned about how they made this happen is that Gurdjieff traveled a lot around East Asia and studied a lot about spirituality and enlightenment. And
he studied the traditional spiritual practices of like the yogis and the monks and the fakirs. And then he developed his own approach to spirituality and self-development, self-betterment, which he called the fourth way.
Right.
The first three ways being that of the yogis, the monks, and the fakirs, which I think correlate to the body, the emotions, and the mind. Something like that. Like the yogis are the body, the monks are the emotions, and the fakirs are the mind. Something like that.
So the fourth way is like the ultimate path to self-realization in a
way? Right. And I think it was his way of sort of making the ancient Eastern spiritual traditions accessible to a Western audience. And so one of the ways the fourth way practiced spirituality was through transcendental music and dance. And so the music of this box set that we're putting out was written by Gurdjieff with the help of de Hartmann as a means of meditation to reach transcendence.
Yeah, and de Hartmann, he was born in what is now known as the Ukraine, and he studied under some really famous composers and also was friends with Rainer Marie Wilke and Vasily Kandinsky as well. He studied with Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, who did the Flight of the Bumblebee. Yep. He studied with
him. I remember
him.
The cartoon.
Yeah, some other Russian composers of the 19th century, Anton Arensky and Sergei Taneyev, were the other two. But after that, he found himself in partnership with George Gurdjieff. One of the tracks from the music of Gurdjieff de Hartmann is called The Struggle of the Magicians. If that sounds familiar to you, it's probably because it appears on our New Age box set, I Am the Sinner. And coincidentally, it also appears as the opening track on the Psychic Migrations original soundtrack that we'll be talking about in just a few minutes. We had the opportunity to sit down and have a discussion with the foremost Gurdjieff archivist and music conservationist, Charles Ketchum. He is also a composer himself, as well as a conductor.
Yeah, he's conducted a lot of the major orchestras in the U.S., the Pittsburgh Symphony, the Dallas Symphony, St. Louis Symphony, and he's also conducted orchestras in France, Italy, Holland, Denmark, and he's just super knowledgeable about Gurdjieff, and a really sweet guy.
This release wouldn't have been possible without him.
Absolutely, yeah. He's been like the safeguard of this music for the past, you know, several decades, I think.
We called him up while he was at a cafe and asked him about the release and what he thought about it.
Is the background okay? I'm in a little restaurant, but it seems fairly quiet. So is it okay for you?
I think it's okay, yeah.
I'm ready, if you are.
All right. So let's start it off with, how did you first encounter the music of Gurdjieff de Hartmann?
When I was in my mid-20s, I had read about Gurdjieff's ideas, and I was interested in it, and so within a short time, I began to hear the music played by others. That was my first acquaintance with it, because at that time, mid-60s, at that time, none of the music was published or available to the public.
So it was the philosophy that initially drew you to music.
Yes, his ideas, yes, right.
So would groups of people gather and someone would play piano and everyone else would dance?
They would have certain movements, exercises, and there was music that was provided for it that had been written already. In fact, it's the very first music in which Gurdjieff and de Hartmann collaborated, which was music that was written for certain specific movements or exercises or dances.
Who is choreographing these dances?
Gurdjieff did. They're all from him.
Oh, wow. Okay. That is so interesting to me. Was sacred dancing and the music, was it to the end of feeling a sense of community, or was it more like transcendence, or what was the purpose or function?
I would say it was multi-layered. I think one could say that his primary aim was to increase the capacity of attention. But that's only one layer. The other layers start to speak about helping support a contact with something more spiritual inside. And that's, in a way, when we speak about the music for the piano, which is being released by you again in April, it has that same layer of meaning. Some of it's really something very enjoyable. You can whistle it. Others are more complex and really speak to a more spiritual side.
Where were you when this was going
on? Well, this was near New York City. At the time, Gurdjieff had already visited New York in the late 40s, and so any number of people established a foundation to continue what he had brought, people who knew him.
As a musician and a student of classical music, I believe,
yes.
Would you be able to tell us a bit about the historical context of this music, because it seems somewhat ahead of its time?
You know, it's interesting that de Hartmann himself was one of the foremost musicians and composers in Russia at the time of the revolution. But because he had to leave, and because he met Gurdjieff, much of his own work was subjugated to trying to make to bring alive the music that Gurdjieff wanted to. But among the people that he had contacted and known was Kandinsky, and it was a circle of people exploring new ways of bringing meaning to art in general. In that context, he knew Schoenberg, he knew all these avant-garde composers. How does that translate into the music he wrote with Gurdjieff? Some of it has nothing to do with that. It's just using the influence of the Orthodox Church and the influence that Gurdjieff had received from his travels in the Middle East. But when you really look at it carefully, there are quite a few pieces which have, I would say, harmonic progressions and harmonic clusters that already foretold much of what took place in the 20th century. I guess I wouldn't characterize it as necessarily ahead of his time, but certainly I'm able to express a kind of begins of a new language of music, all of which was taking place at the same time with Stravinsky and Schoenberg and these composers. But it's unique. The music is not like any other music. People hear because they don't have a reference, they hear connections to Satie or to other people. But mm-hmm. it's its own music, and very often very creative, yeah.
From what I understand, his travels in Asia brought in an Eastern influence to what may have been a more Western style of music.
Yes, that's right. We pondered over that a lot, because when you read the Hartman's own book about his life with Gurdjieff, Gurdjieff speaks about that influence. But piano is clearly a Western instrument. One of the main differences is the tuning. All the Middle Eastern countries, in fact, anywhere in the world, both places in the world, the tunings are to a much more fundamental and organic and true tuning than the piano. The piano is an adjusted, what's called the well-tempered tuning, which is really out of tune. You know, that you can't retune a piano for each piece. So in that sense, it's a very Western instrument. But Gurdjieff found the means to transmit something of what he wanted through that instrument, partly because he had de Hartman, who was a great pianist, really one of the great pianists at that time. This was a challenge for Gurdjieff to bring what he heard and felt was essential about it into a Western setting.
In the same way that, Gurdjieff translated Eastern melodies and sounds into a Western instrument, the philosophy was sort of a translation of Eastern philosophies that Gurdjieff studied into sort of a Westernized way of thinking?
Yes, I think you could say that. I mean, it's well known of the ashrams in India and places like that where people renounce life and go into these ashrams for a spiritual development.
Mm-hmm.
But Gurdjieff's view, and maybe it was shaped by what he saw in the West, his view was that the practice of his teaching was to be done in life. You didn't give up anything in life in terms
right.
of you lived life fully. And so
right.
One could say in the broadest sense that this was an adaptation of how traditionally in the East, people who were seeking a spiritual path basically renounced everything. So
mm-hmm.
that's one adaptation, I would say. But, there are many others, but that would be fundamental, yes.
Mind, body, spirit kind of, right?
Yeah, right. And the fourth way is all of them combined, but you don't get, you continue in your life. And so
right.
a precursor to the New Age. But musically, I must tell you very honestly, all the music that I've heard in New Age music is very, very different from what Gurdjieff brought.
Yeah, the similarities may be more philosophical.
That's right, more than musically, because musically it's steeped in very great pedagogy that de Hartman received in Russia,
mm-hmm.
and the mm-hmm. harmonic movement, even though it's influenced somewhat by the Middle East, is still very steeped in Western, the Western legacy of the development of music from Gregorian chant on. There's an ambience which is sought to bring people to a more spiritual sense of life.
Yeah.
So much of the music of Gurdjieff is very melodic, it has a very, people who never heard the music are attracted to its simplicity and its, you can feel a connection right away.
Yeah. So I was going to say, because you are, as far as I know, the foremost archivist of all this material, if you hadn't gotten involved in this, do you think someone else just would have done it? Or do you think the music would have been lost? Like, what do you think, what would have happened to it if you hadn't intervened?
I think that eventually something would have come out. In fact, already in the early 50s, privately published were a number of the pieces. De Hartman was still alive. That's why we have them. We had them. It was a French edition, and there were several people, especially John de Salzman, who is credited with continuing his teaching, the main person for until she died in 1990. I don't know if it would have been in the same way as I think myself and my two colleagues, we saw to it that it was a very comprehensive publication. but this is also was wished for by Jean de Salzman. So I would say that, but I think it would have appeared in some form. Actually, one of the things of which prompted it to get moving quickly was the fact that Keith Jarrett made it a very early recording of the music, which was a shock to everybody. Because
the jazz musician, right?
Yeah, and a great, yes. But he found in it this improvisatory quality, which is one of the compositional features of the music, that attracted him. In the end, he said, you know, this is what my contribution is. He says that those of you who really know the music really should be the ones putting more of it out and making it available. So the first thing was to publish in four volumes the complete set of music. There are in other areas he's considered the beginning of the New Age approach to life, you know, spiritual. And, you know, you find it more and more accepted. It was, you know, 50, 60 years ago, yoga or any other was really frowned, looked down on, actually, not very accepted in the mainstream. Today, many, even great corporations use certain things of practice for people to function better.
Mindfulness is being taught from school children nowadays.
Right, exactly.
Which I think is so great.
That's a big change, it counters the opposite events that are going on in the world that are so horrible, right?
Speaking of that, how do you think this music translates in today's world to a newer audience, to younger people?
And to people who know perhaps nothing of Gurdjieff's philosophy.
It's very interesting I've played, now dozens of concerts in different parts of the world, just his music. And many people come without knowing anything about it. And many, many people simply are touched by it, something which they can't define, but they find it changes something for them and they feel very positive. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to become followers, but they recognize that there's something in the music as a whole that is very human and touches people's hearts, if you want to put it that way.
Absolutely. Their feelings. I agree with that.
So I can't say but if people are open, it does. And there are many people who are interested in Gurdjieff's ideas who aren't necessarily practitioners, but they feel something that is what he had to say about humankind, and his main question was why we're here living, why are we on earth, and so it touches people, and I don't know that it's going to change anything or it's going to, you know, but some people have been very attracted to produce ideas of the music.
All right, well, thank you so much for taking the time, Charles.
Thank you both very much.
The second Record Store Day release that we're going to get into is the soundtrack to a film called Chow Manhattan. Have you seen that movie?
I have. I actually had never heard of it before. But I rented it on Amazon.
Oh, is that a commercial for Amazon?
Well, I guess it would be good for people
Amazon,
to know.
Are you going to give us money? Are you out there?
Anyway, it's Chow Manhattan is a 1973 avant-garde sort of art film starring Edie Sedgwick, the famous pop art it girl who was famously friends with Andy Warhol and hung out in the Warhol factory scene for a bit in the 60s. Edie herself was an heiress from California who wound up in New York as a model and actress and maybe had a little too much fun in the New York City party scene. And this movie, Chow Manhattan, which was co-directed and co-produced by John Palmer and David Wiseman, who we're going to talk to in a little bit, David Wiseman, sort of
tells Edie's story through a very thin veil of fiction. The main character of the movie is called Susan Superstar, but she's sort of loosely, not that loosely, based on Edie herself. The movie finds Susan Superstar living in an emptied pool in her on her mother's mansion grounds and reflecting on her glamorous life back in New York.
Speed is the ultimate all-time high. That first rush. Wow. Just that burning, searing, soaring sense of perfection. Like, oh God, a 24-hour climax that can go
just
on for days.
A while, I like to go off and have
different... To the city or to the country?
To the country, to an island, near the sea. I mean, I can live there happily ever after.
There's no way to explain it unless you've been through it. There's no way to tell anyone who hasn't tasted it. I'd like to turn the whole world on just for a moment. Just for a moment.
There is an article about Chow Manhattan that came from a December 1972 issue of Variety. And one of my favorite sentences that describes the plot is that in the last years of her life, says this intendedly anti-dope film, Sedgwick took up residence at the bottom of a tinted Santa Barbara pool, narcissistically surrounded by giant blow-ups of herself. It is here that the film dwells, cruelly exploiting her dope and booze-bloated visage, her siliconed breast. For at least half the pic, she is topless. So proud is she of these new ornaments. And most of the non-plot consists of her drug-zonked recollections of her halcyon days.
I mean, I don't know if it's like a cruel exploitation. It might be, but I think it's more of just like a meditation on drugs and celebrity and how damaging that all can be.
Which probably didn't become apparent until the end of the filming when Edie herself died from...
Right.
A barbiturate overdose.
Yeah, at age 28, I think.
When we talked with David Wiseman, on multiple occasions, brought up the fact that even he didn't realize what was real and what was not at some points because it was so close.
Right, which is, and he was saying that Edie might as well be credited as one of the writers because she directed the plot as much as they did. I just wanted to mention a fun fact, that Edie Sedgwick apparently was the muse for Femme Fatale by the Velvet Underground, as well as Just Like a Woman and Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat by Bob Dylan.
She was quite the magnetic personality, it seemed.
Yeah, I loved the soundtrack.
Yeah, we are here to talk about the soundtrack. Our soundtrack is really interesting because this soundtrack has never been released in any format anywhere. Mm-hmm. This is the first time.
And some of the songs in the soundtrack never existed in any format outside of the film. And so in putting the soundtrack together, our project manager, Patrick, actually had to like spliced together little segments of these songs as they were cut up in the film. It was, I think, really painstaking, crazy work, but it makes this soundtrack release really sort of monumental. It's really fitting. It's really dark and psychedelic, and it features a lot of early Moog compositions by Gino Pisercchio, who was a factory regular.
He and was BFFs with
David Wiseman.
David Wiseman,
our boy, who we interview. He was, Gino Pisercchio, I think, was gifted one of the first Moog synthesizers. And he would just sort of like get fucked up and experiment on this synthesizer and make these really cool compositions. And then every night, at the end, he would just wipe them. And so David Wiseman would sometimes be able to sneak in and, like,
While he was tripping or high or whatever, he could get in there and steal the tapes.
Right, and, like, save some of these tracks.
Duplicate them.
Right, and that was what he ended up using as sort of, like, the anchor of the soundtrack, were these sort of stolen tracks from Gino Pisercchio. Then the rest of the stuff is just music from sort of cult figures of the era, such as John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas and Skip Batten from the Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers and Kim Fowley.
Who you might know as the infamous manager for the Runaways. But before that, he got to start working with Motown founder Berry Gordy. He wrote and produced and managed all sorts of people, had a very long career.
Also, one time he called the light in the attic office.
Wow.
I don't remember why, but Jack, our coworker, took a picture of the caller ID because it said Kim Fowley. Cool. Or like Fowley Kim.
Before my time. Another big part of the soundtrack is the inclusion of Richie Havens. Richie Havens is really interesting because he got his start at the Woodstock Festival in 1969. He was scheduled as the opening act there, and there was so much traffic trying to get to the festival that the performers following him were so late that they kind of just had to keep going. They had him keep playing. He ended up playing for almost 3 hours.
Oh my God, I did not know that.
Yeah. He played for almost 3 hours, but the whole audience wanted encores. Like, that's kind of where his fame kind of took off, because he held this crowd for 3 hours while they were waiting for Jimi Hendrix, you know? God,
what a crazy start to a career.
Yeah, so he was able to hold his shit together for that long. I think his career was kind of solidified from that point on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think David Wiseman was just a really big fan of his. Mm-hmm. So he included a few of his tracks in the soundtrack.
So we went to David Wiseman's home in Hollywood and talked to him and his very cute bulldog named Butch the Fourth.
Butch the Fourth.
And that's what you're going to hear right now.
Hi, I'm David Wiseman. I am co-director of Chow Manhattan with John Palmer. John Palmer and I were both fringe characters of the Warhol Factory. And in 1966, there was a kind of a mini revolt where many of the people who were hanging around the factory, the original factory on 47th Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenue in New York City, got kind of tired that nothing was happening, and we all kind of banded together and decided to make a real movie. John Palmer, my partner in this venture, was a bit younger than me, 2-3 years younger than me. He was around 21 at the time, 22. And John had he was a prodigy. He had shot Andy's first film, Empire. So a group of us, including a character named Chuck Wine, who was the original director, but was a bit over the top and drugs and so forth, Genevieve Charbin, his friend with whom he wrote a script that was half finished, and by the time we started shooting Easter Sunday of 1967, we were hardly prepared. The producer, the money came from a guy named Bob Margolef, who had a studio on 47th Street in the Diamond District between 5th and 6th Avenue. It was a kind of little shooting stage he turned into a sound studio. We all kind of congregated there and started making this movie, of which by the time we finished shooting between March and the end of May, by Memorial Day of that, we'd shot the entire budget. We had gone through the entire budget. shot more footage than we ever imagined could be shot on 35 millimeter. Wound up shooting maybe 40%, 50% of the scenes in the unfinished script. And each scene was only maybe 40 or 50% finished. So we had a mess. We had 100,000 feet of beautiful, gorgeous 35 millimeter black and white footage. And meanwhile, Edie, who was the center of, in the center, in the centrifuge of the whole thing, was falling apart. This is where she reached what I call her Icarus moment, where she flew too close to the sun, and she wound up, someone drove her back to California, and she never came back to New York. That was all in the summer of 1967, what they call the summer of love. Gino Pizzarcchio was a key member of this crew. He was in one of the better, the best Warhol films with Edie called Beauty Number Two. He was the boy in the underwear on the bed with Edie, and the voice off screen that's kind of like antagonizing them is Chuck Wein, and Edie winds up throwing an ashtray at him. And I believe that at some point during the, they had a Doberman Pinscher on the bed too. It was a very kind of like erotic, nothing's happening, they're just kind of talking and schmoozing and so forth. But it was, so Gino was always a classical musician. He was from New Jersey. He'd gone to Juilliard, and he was actually the first musician signed by the Beatles' Apple label, by George Harrison, I believe it was. The thing with Gino is he was up all night producing this remarkable material. By the way, Bob Margolef, the owner of the studio, the financier of the movie, he was very much into experimental music. And Robert Moog from Trumansburg, New York, drove down with his first demonstrator and left it in Margolef's studio. Gino promptly threw Margolef out of the studio and said, I'm going to deal with this. And so Gino locked himself in the recording studio for the next year and just would record these remarkable tapes, which at the end, and he's up all night on speed, and then in the morning he would degauss, erase everything. And so the only material that remains from Gino is stuff that I stole once he crashed. And he didn't, you know, I would grab a reel and go dupe it and put it back. And because Gino never felt that anything was good enough. And so it's just a happenstance that any of this exists.
The music in the movie, was that music that you just found in that mode, or did you ever ask him to write anything particular for the film?
Nothing was ever written, was ever scored.
Okay.
Gino would be doing his own material, and it was all very hypnotic. It was a magical moment. So it's hard to tell, you know, what was real and what wasn't. It's just that these were very, very avant-garde, very early Moog synthesizer experiments that he was doing. And I wound up, this is, again, all of this material was generated in 1967, and some of it in 1968. But when the film was being edited, the material that I had basically stolen from Gino without him, you know, I mean, he eventually knew, but he didn't really care. But, I would use pieces and we were very collaborative. I mean, his voice appears throughout the film he's the voice of the doctor, the vitamin doctor. Mm-hmm. So he's always in the background, sound montages, that's his voice. But nothing was scored. It was all just pieces found that might seem to match the montages we were doing.
When you guys released the movie, did people react to the score? Like, was this sort of a new sound at the time, since Moog was just sort of...
Well, the movie wound up taking 5 years to make, from the first day of shooting until the final answer print. There was not any anticipation for the movie because, and by 1968, when the movie was not done, every night I would go into Max's, and Mickey, the owner, sat at the cash register, you know, selecting who gets in and who doesn't. As I'd walk past him, is it done yet? The impulse to finish the film was more of humiliation, to escape the humiliation of having done this thing that got so much publicity and so much anticipation and wound up being the film that would never be finished. So this went on for 5 years. And we had lost not only Edie, who had gone back to California, but the male lead, Paul Johnson, who was in a couple of Warhol films, had also disappeared in the middle of shooting. He just He was supposed to drive around the Pan Am building in his little sports car, and after like 20 drive arounds, he just flung the script and kept driving, and we didn't see him for a year and a half until from literally the middle of 67 until the end of 68. We found him in a jail cell in Michigan, and went out and shot him in his jail cell. He was busted for pot, and so that's how the transition was made from a fiction to this is actually where he is. He's in this jail cell. We got permission from the local sheriff and so forth, which is a story unto itself. And it didn't make a hell of a lot of sense, but at least it started to add a bit of cohesion to the movie and also added another dimension. So at that point, after we shot all this stuff with Paul Johnson, we decided to go out to California the following year and to see what's happening with Edie. And I did that and discovered her, you know, much better. And, you know, in the hospital when she was born, she was in treatment. And she was so excited about finishing the film. So I gathered John and various other characters from various places, and we kind of congregated in California. And then we devised the color footage, which would be a housing device for the black and white footage. So the story would come from Edie in her current 1970 state, telling about her past being only 2 or 3 years earlier. A different world. I mean, time had moved so fast that, you know, what she is in the color. I mean, people actually say, is that really her? Because she changed so much. You know, she deteriorated, if you want to look at it that way. But so by devising this fiction that was based on a kind of like a version of reality, sort of like what we did in the jail cell, by having her live in an empty swimming pool on her mother's estate. This was how this came about, was it's a happenstance. But it turned out to be quite a wonderfully visual and metaphoric way of describing her condition.
So for the rest of the tracks in the film, aside from Gino's, who chose those tracks?
Oh, I did everything. John and I basically were like a married couple, I mean, but he was really one of the amazing, great cinematic eyes of his time, but he never did another film past Shaw Manhattan. We were co-directors, but I basically, he didn't, he was not happy about this. The entire film is dubbed, so I did all the dubbing, and I selected all the music. And John and I had tremendous wars about this because he didn't like any of the selections, and or there was one or two that he didn't like, and blames me for the film never working because I chose the wrong music.
Speaking of...
That's okay. It's all right.
I don't know that I would say that Richie Havens is a bad choice.
Richie Havens was being produced by Margolif. And so it was accessible, and he was someone that we always believed was really a genius performer. And the feeling of it was really so appropriate for the pieces we used.
So you said the other tracks were licensed, so the rest of the tracks were already written before the movie.
Oh yeah, every one of these had already appeared on a record, of which we just found pieces. And John and I, you know, would pretty much agree on most of these. We had some arguments about, you know, he wanted to write, he really, really believed that for a piece in that whole area, the Blackaway area, where there's a Mr. Verdecchio is on the boat and so forth, and the sweeping views of Manhattan, we needed to have a Rolling Stone piece in there, and I agreed too, but we couldn't afford it. Yeah. And so he blames me for not making it happen, but that's okay.
Some of the tracks just sound like they were meant to go in the movie though, like Malibu People and Kim Milford's song Justice. Those sound like they were made for the movie.
I gotta find a beach house, babe, and the waves roll in, playing in the sand with your best friend, babe. Malibu people really know how to live.
Well, these are, I knew John Phillips at the time, and you know, I was in love with his first album, solo album. Malibu People was one of the tracks, and it really, you know, we wound up shooting an opening in the film based upon that song. you know, with the hope that we could get the song. I mean, you know, we didn't have an opening for the film. We wanted Wesley, the Texan, to pick up Edie hitchhiking, and she brings him home. And we shot in Old Malibu, Colony Road. And I can't remember which came first, the song or the footage, but they kind of came together. And when we found this estate in Arcadia upon which to shoot the film, it just was a natural for, there was a Byrds album, I can't remember which one, but it was a song by Skip Batten and Kim Fowley, which was Citizen Kane. And the estate was a kind of like a chintzy version, rundown version of Xanadu.
A fat, ugly, fat man swam in a red tire made of stone. The painted lady paddled next to him with two poodles on her lap.
That was one song that we did not use the master from the original but album, but we got Kim Fowley and Skip Batten into a recording studio, and they re-recorded it, so I didn't have to pay for the master.
So
they owned the publishing rights.
So in some cases, the scenes were kind of based around the songs.
I think only in the case of Malibu People and Citizen Kane, and I'm not sure which came first, the chicken or the egg, but they were integrally interlocked.
Were these tracks that you chose for the film reflective of what you were listening to at the
yes.
time?
Oh, yeah, the cool. tracks were always, in almost every case, reflective of things that we were listening to at the time. And if not, you know, in every case, it was something that we were, was part of the mood mm-hmm. during which we were shooting the color footage. The time being 1970 into 71, when the final film was being edited. They were reflective of what we're listening to, yeah.
I was sort of surprised that the soundtrack's never been released before in any format. Is there any particular reason for that,
Tina? The soundtrack was never released until now because the impracticality of hunting down the rights, because honestly, it needed someone like Light in the Attic to go after this and to really want to make it happen. And it's been we've been discussing this for years. But they're never, I mean, you have to understand Chow Manhattan is an acquired taste for most people. It's not exactly, you know, a movie that was financially successful. It's unique. It's a cult objet trouvé, you know. Some people think it's incomprehensible and confusion. Other people think it's a transcendental experience. It's probably somewhere in the middle.
How do you feel about the soundtrack coming out now?
Oh, I'm very excited. I think they're doing a great job, and I'm really happy to see it come out.
The track you are currently hearing is Flight Patterns by Al Lover. That comes from our soundtrack to the movie Psychic Migrations, our third Record Store Day release. Psychic Migrations is kind of exciting for us because it is a surf documentary that was put out by Volcom, which is kind of a departure from our normal demographic, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's still really new for us to be putting out music by people who are alive and playing shows, and a lot of the artists on this soundtrack are. The opening track to this surf film is a Gurdjieff to Hartman track called The Struggle of the Magicians.
Having the Gurdjieff to Hartman track as the opening track to Psychic Migrations, the film, is really fitting because this film has no dialogue and no text. And so having this minimalist, avant-garde piano composition, it just feels right.
It does. It's interesting that our last two Record Store Day releases are both really meditative. Because both Gurdjieff and the Psychic Migrations film and soundtrack
are sort of trance-inducing.
And you kind of hear a little bit about that when we talk to the director, Ryan Thomas, and the music supervisor, Kurt Mindes, about that.
Mm-hmm. And I think Hillary and I both had similar experiences watching the film for the first time at home.
Were you as stoned as I was?
Yep. Great. Highly recommended.
It was beautiful. I was floored.
Yeah, so the music is a mix. I mean, so it opens with that Gurdjieff track, and then the rest of the soundtrack is sort of this like trancey mix of drone and
psych
and garagey vibes. So some of the artists are Bitchin' Bajas, Wand, Cave, White Fence, which we played at the beginning of the episode, The OCs, Al Lover, which we played to introduce this segment.
It's a really good, eclectic mix of artists.
So we got to interview the film's director, Ryan Thomas, and the music supervisor, Kurt Mindes, and we had our coworker, Jack, who is a surfer and knows a lot more about this stuff than we do, join us for the chat.
I'm Kurt Mindes, and I was the music supervisor for Psychic Migrations.
And I'm Ryan Thomas. I was the director of the film.
Could you guys tell us a little about your approach to soundtracking the film?
Well, to start off, this was the first film that Kurt and I worked on together.
Basically, the concept was that we didn't want to have music in there that was too familiar that people would have already heard. You know, sometimes people with their soundtracks get the idea that like, oh, we have to have, you know, Metallica or something.
Yeah, on that note, we didn't want to try and create something new, and then when somebody watches it, it's getting mixed in with the experiences that they've already had with a popular song. As far as picking the music that we picked, I really wanted to give a sense of traveling the world in this film, and really traveling through nature, really, and to have kind of, I don't like using like a world music. I feel like that's, but have
thing. It was world music, not world music.
Yeah. I wanted some sort of like there. I wanted there to be if we are going to use the label of world music, but world music that's been mixed or affected by Western music, psychedelic music, rock music. The soundtrack, at the end of the day, it really was a good thread for us to work off of together, finding music, and it definitely served as a great jumping point, because when I told him that, you know, that's kind of the thing that I wanted, he immediately put on a Al Lover record, and I was like, yes, that's exactly the kind of thing that I'm looking for.
And I'd say I gave you a lot of other music, too.
Oh, yeah. That didn't work.
That was like that helped also. You were like, not this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't really want drum machines or something like that.
Yeah, Kurt was amazing at, I would say, I'm looking for this kind of vibe for this segment of the film. And then he would disappear for a little while and come back with a handful of stuff for me to listen to. And more often than not, like, I would find exactly what I was looking for.
So would you have like a scene in particular that you wanted to find something for, and then you would kind of ask Kurt to find something for that scene, or did you have sort of like a handful of things that you knew you wanted to use and then tried to find them, fit them to the movie?
It's usually a mix of both. Mm-hmm. The only stuff that I used in the film that was not via a dialogue between me and Kurt was the OCs, mm-hmm. and music from my friend Steve Hadley, which is used in the credit sequence at mm-hmm. the end of the film.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask about the opening song, which is a Gurdjieff to Hartman track, which is one of our other Record Store Day releases, actually, is the full album by Gurdjieff to Hartman. Yeah. And I just thought it was such a cool use of that song because it's really unexpected, kind of, for a surf film, I think, because it's like this mellow, super simple, just piano, sort of like eerie melody played over surfers getting ready to go out, basically. Mm-hmm. How did you guys end up finding that track? And do you have any thoughts about like its unexpectedness in the film genre?
I don't remember what our exact conversation was. I just dig piano. I don't think I had a specific idea for it at that point. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ease the viewer into the film, and I wanted to have sort of a sense of this like kind of walkabout little journey. I just decided that it symbolically needed the best symbolic use of it would just be to open up the film with it, and it just needed something simple to go with it, and the simplicity of the walking seemed to match go hand in hand with the simplicity of just piano, and that's all it is.
Yeah.
I wanted there to be a I didn't want the beginning to be feel real dense.
Mm-hmm.
Music is so important with the surf movies, especially movies that don't have any interviews in them with the surfers themselves. I mean, the music is your mood. It's one shot to one set of music. It's going to make someone feel one way, and you can use the exact same shot with a different paired to a different piece of music, and it's going to say an entirely different thing to the person that watches it. So, I can't say enough about how important and crucial the music is in this sort of film.
I think, and not to sound like too much of a plug for the record, like seeing this record actually that it was made, that's going to come out to work on it with you guys, is very rewarding. I've worked at Vulcan for over 10 years, always as like a music guy, and you know, we used to put out records, and in particular we had a vinyl club where we had subscriptions and did limited releases and stuff like that. And just because of changes in our business and stuff, we had gotten away from it. Like within 5 minutes of the movie premiering, like someone's asking, are you going to put that out? And I'm just feeling kind of like, nah, we don't like do that anymore.
Right.
The whole process was a real pleasure to do. Definitely the best music supervision experience I've ever had. And a lot of that has to do with working with RT. We were like on the same level, and just I was vibing on the way the soundtrack was coming together. The Gurdjieff to Hartman, is it Gurdjieff or Gurdjieff?
Gurdjieff.
Yeah, I think Gurdjieff. I think we spelled it wrong in the credits.
Yeah.
on the movie.
It's all
right. We got it right for the soundtrack.
Yeah.
Gurdjieff and to Hartman, that was like the most out there song that I'd ever licensed up to that point, just to track down the publishing rights. And it was just weird because like usually when I talk to people, they're immediately like trying to get into it, like either trying to run you up or just, oh yeah, cool, surfing, great. You know, like they're just like, why are you trying to talk to us? Like, I don't get this.
Well, I remember
that. And then we got it placed. And like you were saying earlier in the interview, I mean, it really is an interesting placement to me. And that's though it was maybe a little more complicated than some of the other songs to license, that was really rewarding to accomplish that.
Totally. I was just going to say, I remember when you originally hit me up about it, you're like, yeah, you know, I think we're interested in using this song. I was like, really? Well, I did.
He did, right? RT said, like, I want a piano song, and you know, whatever sort of vibe we were looking for, I threw your way, and you'd send me some stuff. And
I think you originally said you're looking for some like out of the box type shit. I was like, okay, well, this is totally fucking out of the box. But yeah, even when you came back and you're like, yeah, I think we're interested in this, I was like, really? Okay, rad. Yeah, I think it's definitely a standout film, and you know, that's kind of what led us to want to do the soundtrack, because it's just so different from any other surf films that I've seen. I've been surfing since I was a little kid.
I think it's a future classic.
Definitely. Thanks, guys, for coming by.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to our Record Store Day 2017 episode. Be sure to check out these releases at your local shop on Saturday, April 22nd, and we'll see you next time.
Also, visit our website, lightintheattic.net, for more information on any of these releases.
And of course, many thanks to our life-saving producer, Michelle Lanz.
And to our lovely interviewees.
Yes. All of them, thank you.